long. An hour later, Hannah picked at her dinner at the small table that served as a dining room, her laptop next to her. The living conditions of the small farmstead apartment should have been uncomfortable for a wealthy American, but she had a genuine appreciation for the simplicity of it all. She tried to email her parents, but the farm's satellite internet signal was down, as usual. Headlights flashed across the ceiling as a vehicle turned onto her lane, the beams casting eerie shadows as they filtered through the high window frames. She heard footfalls on the stone walkway as a figure approached. Visitors after nightfall were not a normal occurrence. Listening to her sixth sense, Hannah looked around for something to use as a weapon and picked up a battered kitchen knife. The knock at the door sent a shiver down her spine, but a woman's voice put her at ease.
"Excuse me,"
the woman said in Romanian. Hannah peeked through the window shade and saw a young, well-dressed female.
"Can I help you?"
"My husband and I are lost. Is this the road to the bed and breakfast?"
She could see that the woman was holding a smartphone, presumably trying to find a location on the map that would not come up due to that lack of coverage in the area. Still suspicious, Hannah unlocked the door and stepped out to help, holding the knife in her right hand, the blade pressed upward against her forearm to conceal it. The woman smiled and held out the phone so that Hannah could see the map. She leaned in to see where she was pointing.
"Thank you so much."
Hannah opened her mouth to respond, but was grabbed in a powerful bear hug from behind. She slashed backward with the knife and felt the resistance of clothing, flesh, and bone. The vice grip loosened as her attacker grunted in pain. Twisting away, she turned and ran back through the doorway, sprinting through her home for the back door that led into the night. If she could get out of the house, she would have a 200-yard dash to the forest. She heard footsteps behind her and threw a chair into the doorway to slow her pursuer.
"Almost there. The back door. A chance to escape."
Slamming her shoulder into the back door, she catapulted herself toward the tree line and was knocked to the ground with a 2x4 to the face. She fell backward, crashing back into the door frame, the knife slipping from her grasp. Bloodied and barely conscious against the side of the house, she had no defense when the man she had stabbed appeared and struck the left side of her head. Before the others pulled him off, he landed another blow where her jawline met her ear, sending her spiraling into darkness. Chapter 52. Boundary County, Idaho, United States-Canadian border. He'd seen the technique once before, and it had stayed with him, having been attached to the CIA in the days when IEDs became a tactical weapon of strategic importance. Reese had witnessed the unleashing of the most aggressive elements of the U.S. intelligence apparatus. Though Americans were strictly prohibited from practicing the darkest arts of tactical interrogation, they could teach host nation forces some of the more refined elicitation methods and then leave the room when partner force interrogators applied their most recent knowledge on the enemy. Reese knew the importance of maintaining the moral high ground in war. Sometimes that's all that distinguished the good guys from the bad. If you abandoned the moral high ground, all was lost.
"You've lost your way, Reese. Tell that to your wife and daughter."
Reese swung the med kit from his shoulder and looked at the man strapped naked to the leather chair in front of him. Reese and Liz had set the chair on a tarp to help contain the inevitable DNA. Rigger's tape secured the prisoner's legs, arms, and upper chest to the chair. A rope fixed in a noose was looped securely around his head and was tied to a beam running the length of the cabin. He wasn't going anywhere. The man was covered in ink. Almost every inch of his body was overwritten by intricate tattoos. Saints, angels, skulls, and coffins covered his chest and back. A giant cathedral with multiple domes dominated the scene. A hooded executioner branded each shoulder, and roses stood out from his forearms,
one twisting around a dagger, the other wrapped in barbed wire. Reese didn't know much about Russian tattoos, but what he did know was that they signified the man before him had spent time in some of the toughest prisons on Earth and survived. While working for the CIA, Reese had learned techniques carefully designed to elicit responses from the most hardened Islamic terrorists. What he took away was that regardless of the technique, as an interrogator, you had to offer hope. Hope was the key. He wondered how it would work with a hardened Bratva enforcer. He was about to find out. Reese moved forward and felt the pulse at the man's neck, slow and weak. He needed the Russian alive for at least an hour. Returning to the med kit, Reese took out an IV and a length of 550 cord. He threw the cord over the exposed beam that held the noose and attached it to the IV bag dangling just to the side of the Russian's head. His veins stood out like pipes, probably due to the copious amounts of steroids that sustained his muscular physique. Reese stabbed the needle of the 18-gauge catheter into a vein running through the rose and dagger on his subject's right arm. He pulled the hub, withdrawing the needle and leaving the plastic sheath in the vein. He then attached the tube and opened the IV spin valve to flood the tubing with fluid after taping it to the arm. He ran the bag wide open to replace the fluids necessary to stabilize the Russian for questioning. When the first bag had drained, Reese attached a second, watching an air bubble move down the tube. "Enjoy your rest, my friend," Reese whispered. "You'll need all your strength for what's coming." "And so will I," Reese thought. The Scoville scale measures heat in Scoville heat units, in this case specifically the heat of peppers, a heat that comes from the neuropeptide-releasing agent capsaicin, which they contain. Reese put on rubber gloves and clear eyeglasses from the med kit and dumped Jonathan's red ghost peppers out on a cutting board in the small kitchen. Reese was after the capsaicin. He'd seen the process done in sterile conditions at the CIA over a series of days. Reese didn't have days, he had hours. He was going to do what SEALs did best: improvise. Preheating the oven to 350 degrees, he moved back to the cutting board and sliced the ghost peppers down the middle, removing the seeds and separating the white pith that contained the capsaicin. Careful not to touch his face, he put the pith on a baking sheet and threw it in the oven to dry it out. Opening and closing cupboards, Reese found what he was looking for: a coffee grinder, French press, and a bottle of Jack Daniels. Sinatra Select, not bad, Reese thought. 5 minutes later, Reese returned to the oven and removed his baking sheet. He then slid the dried pith into the hand grinder, which he cranked over a bowl, turning it into a coarse powder. He then added 4 shots of Jack Daniel's finest and began to stir. If time was not of the essence, he would have let it sit for a week or two in pure alcohol. "I hope this works." When the consistency was that of slush, he poured it into the French press and pushed down on the strainer, leaving a hazy, brownish solution of pure liquid. Carefully, Reese filled a 60cc syringe with his concoction, remembering the CIA doctor who had taught him this technique all those years ago. When Reese had asked how hot it was, the doctor had answered, "If you were eating a jalapeno pepper, it would measure about 5,000 Scoville heat units. This solution has a Scoville heat unit measurement of over 3 million. It will burn them alive from the inside out, but without the fire." The Russian's head was beginning to sway, signifying the fentanyl was wearing off. "Good." Reese sealed his resolve and approached the man he hoped had answers. Reese brought his leg up and slammed it down directly on the Russian's broken leg, eliciting an animalistic scream. Rhys stepped behind him and tore the rigger's tape from his eyes, then grabbed a chair from the small kitchen table and turned it around so that its back was facing his subject. He sat down, rubber gloves, eye protection, and syringe all clearly visible to the Russian, who blinked his eyes and slowly took in his surroundings.
"Hi," Rhys said as pleasantly as possible. "I'm James Rhys. You tried to kill me and Rafe Hastings earlier today. I have some questions for you."
The Russian's breathing was slow and labored. His head was restrained by the noose, but his eyes moved to his leg, then back to Rhys. In heavily accented English, he responded,
"My leg. Something for my leg."
"Oh, don't worry about your leg. That's about to be the very least of your problems." One of the first rules of interrogation was to only ask questions to which you already knew the answers. Rhys started with what he already knew from his phone call with Vic Rodriguez.
"Let's start with an easy one. Who is Ivan Zharkov?"
"Сейчас поебалу получишь, сука, блядь!"
The Russian spat, his muscles straining to break free of the tape that kept him securely in place. Without a word, Rhys stood and walked behind him and grabbed the noose, wrenching his head back and to the side, slamming his free hand onto his adversary's face and prying his right eye open. With the syringe, Rhys administered a drop of the capsaicin solution and stepped back. The effect was immediate. The Russian's eye turned an instantaneous red, and his mouth opened in a roar of agony from a level of pain he had never experienced, body thrashing as his hands desperately fought to break free of the tape that bound them to the chair. Had they been free, he would have ripped his own eyeball from his head, the agony feeling like a blade pivoting through his eye from the deep recesses of his brain.
"That's one drop, comrade," Rhys said. "I have this entire syringe and more where that came from. Let's try that again. Who is Ivan Zharkov?"
The Russian blinked, blood tears running down his face, his body doing its best to clear itself of this foreign invader. Then, taking a moment, he took in his antagonizer. This was James Rhys, his target. He knew Ivan should have used a team from Wagner Group. He was a bratok in the Bratva. He hadn't broken in Black Dolphin prison, and he certainly wouldn't break for this American. Ivan Zharkov had gotten him out of that hellhole. The Pakhan would get him out of this one. He was almost a brigadier in the organization. He would not break.
"Cigarette?"
the Russian asked.
"Nope, those things will kill you."
The Russian looked at his tormentor.
"Сука, блядь!"
he said, attempting to spit at Rhys.
"I was afraid you might say that. Don't go anywhere," Rhys said, standing and returning to the med kit.
"He's not giving you a choice, Rhys." Rhys closed his eyes and took a breath, seeing a vision of the Russian standing above a gagged and bound Katie, terror in her eyes. Rhys selected another 60cc syringe and filled it with tap water. He then ripped open a Foley catheter bag from the kit and emptied its contents on the table.
"Do it, Rhys."
Rhys opened the 14-gauge catheter and lubed it with the provided KY jelly. He then turned and marched back to his subject. Ignoring the stream of threats in Russian, Rhys grabbed his prisoner's penis with his gloved hand and threaded the catheter down his urethra. Unable to move, the Russian continued to thrash his head as much as the noose would allow. Rhys applied pressure to his captive's broken femur with his elbow and only stepped back when he saw yellow urine appear in the drainage bag. Rhys then attached a 10cc syringe preloaded with saline to a side port, which blew up a small balloon anchoring the system inside the bladder. Rhys gave it a yank to ensure it was in place.
"You think you can make me talk American? I used to rape guys like you in prison. I used to rape wives in front of husbands, daughters in front of fathers, and then chop them up in little pieces. You think you are tough
American. I think I'll fuck that little blonde bitch of yours right in front of you. How would you like that, you weak piece of shit?
Reese kept his composure, unhooked the catheter bag, and attached the syringe filled with the capsaicin solution. He took another look at the bloodied mafia hitman in front of him and pushed in 5 cc's of pain. 8 seconds later, the Russian's body contorted in agony as his bladder erupted in an uncontrollable spasm, coupled with the most intense cramping imaginable. His body naturally attempted to curl up and vomit, but the noose and tape held him in place, vomit spewing from his nose and mouth, eyes bulging from his head. Reese waited 30 seconds and then attached the syringe with water, flushing the capsaicin from the Russian's system. Reese stepped back, waiting for his breathing to return to normal.
Maybe that first question was too difficult, Reese said, disconnecting the clean syringe and reattaching the one with capsaicin. Let's try something easier. What's your name?
What harm could that do?
Dimitri thought. Instead, all that came out between labored breaths, chunks of vomit still falling from his mouth, was,
"Fuck you!"
Reese didn't hesitate. Depressing the plunger, he sent 15 cc of his homemade mixture, 3 times the original dose, into the Russian's bladder. Then he stepped back. The results were horrific. The man's neck strained against the noose as he began to foam at the mouth, choking, cramping, vomiting, emitting a visceral cry reserved for those in the throes of death. Reese counted the seconds ticking by on his watch, giving a full minute this time before flushing the system again. Then he waited as the animal became human, trying desperately to breathe.
Who was this American?
I already know that Ivan Zharkov ordered the hit. I know he is the head of the Tambov gang. I know you work for him. You won't be betraying him. I'm already going to hunt him down and kill him. Nothing you say will change that. And as you've probably figured out, you are not leaving here alive. What I need to know is why. If you can tell me that, I can offer you a quick death. His detainee paused in thought.
James Reese, I studied you. I knew we needed a professional team. Yet we almost killed you with a group of thugs. In the Bratva we learned too. They will come again. And this time they won't just be after you and your friend. The next time they come, it will be professionals. You've insulted their honor now. That is something that Brodva will not let, how you say, lie. They will kill you all. Wives, children, especially children. The Bratva doesn't want to fight another generation. They might even fuck a few of your women to death and make you watch. They will come for you, and they will kill every last one of you.
Reese knew it was true. In his head, he saw visions of the dead. There was only one way this ended, and it was up to Reese to finish it. Reese slowly picked through the med kit until he found a connector from the IV kit and attached it to the syringe, which he then connected to the Y port on the IV drip. Last chance, Reese said.
Fuck you,
the Russian said without much enthusiasm.
He's close.
Reese slightly depressed the plunger, releasing what he hoped was about 1 cc of capsaicin into the IV drip and directly into the Russian's bloodstream. A blood-curdling scream filled the cabin as every single pain receptor in the Russian's body ignited at once, like a bolt of lightning hitting brain, muscles, and organs, a pain worse than the previous 2 capsaicin exposures threatened to boil the Russian from the inside out. Intestinal fluids began to spew from his lungs, while brain secretions worked their way into his nasal cavity and labyrinth of his inner ear. His heart felt like it was about to explode. Via the bloodstream was the most painful delivery method for the solution, but it was also the most short-lived. A person would metabolize the 1cc solution in about 30 seconds to a minute, depending on weight, composition, and body type. Rhys kept slowly injecting the serum as he sensed it was beginning to subside.
What?
I can't hear you, Rhys said over the screams.
Only you can stop this. Ivan is as good as dead. Just tell me why he sent you and I'll end your pain.
Sensing that the Russian's body and brain were about to give out completely, Rhys gave the man a moment of reprieve.
Dmitri,
the man said, coming down from what felt like a blowtorch working every portion of his body and brain.
My name is Dmitri Mashkov.
See, that wasn't so hard. Keep talking, or I keep pushing this shit into your system.
Please, please.
It's all up to you. Remember, Ivan Zharkov put you here. The Russian attempted to catch his breath. He wanted to die.
I was a prisoner in penal colony number 6 for 7 years. Do you know this place?
I can't say I'm familiar.
It is the oldest prison in all of Russia. They call the prisoners the maniacs. A fitting term, no? Terrorists, child molesters, serial killers, even cannibals. Life sentences only. No one gets out.
No one but you?
Ivan Zharkov got me out and brought me back to the Brotherhood. Promoted me. Vakhan did not put me here. The one who betrayed us did. The only reason I am talking to you is so you can find the man who betrayed this mission.
How do you know someone betrayed it?
How do you Americans put it? This was not my first cattle drive. You avoided the ambush, and now you are asking me about Ivan Zharkov a few hours later.
Tell me about him.
He worked his way up. He was a foot soldier, like me. In 1991, Russia became like your cowboy West, I think you say. He saw opportunity, and is now one of the most powerful men in Russia.
Why would he want to kill me? Dmitri hesitated. Why? Rhys demanded, shaking the capsaicin syringe attached to the IV line.
I think it has to do with the American.
The American?
A CIA man defected to Russia and now works for Zharkov.
What CIA man? Rhys asked with renewed interest.
One I escorted from Argentina to Russia. He was an old Soviet mole involved with the President Zubarov assassination.
Son of a bitch, Rhys thought. Oliver Gray. And who do you think betrayed you? Rhys asked.
Someone I should have killed. Long ago, Ivan's son.
Son?
He has many, but the one who is most valuable to the organization is Alexander.
Why?
He's a director in the SVR.
The SVR has ties to the mafia? Rhys asked, pretending he didn't already have the information.
This is Russia. The Bratva intelligence political triad is strong.
I want you to think long and hard about this one. Why would Alexander Zharkov call a contact at the CIA to sell you out moments before the attack? Reese watched as his detainee's eyes flashed with recognition. Tell me.
It is said that Alexander is sick.
He's dying?
No, sick, like, how do you say, crazy?
I don't understand.
Alexander is what I hear called not right in head. He hunts humans.
What? Where?
He leases an island in the Russian Far East from the government. Medne Island. It is said he imports people from Africa, but this is only, how do you say, guess? But if Alexander called your CIA to warn you of the attack, then I want you to kill that suka. I know you can't let me live. In exchange for this information, I want you to kill Alexander Zharkov. Send him to me in the afterlife.
You have my word. Reese would have preferred to put a bullet in Dimitri's head, but that would have left DNA all over the former senator's cabin. This was going to be hard enough to clean up as it was. Depressing the syringe's plunger, Reese pushed the remaining 30 cc's of solution into Dimitri's veins, flooding his system with an overdose of capsaicin. The right side of his brain stroked immediately, the left side of his face dropping into paralysis as blood filled his retinas and brain, the red fluid attempting to escape from its dying host through his nose, mouth, and ears. Almost simultaneously, his bladder and bowels released a mess of bloody excrement. Seconds later, his heart went into fibrillation, and Dimitri went to hell to wait for Alexander Zharkov. Reese stepped outside and grabbed the railing of the deck for balance, taking deep breaths of mountain air while suppressing an urge to vomit. Oliver Gray was in Russia working for the mafia, working for a man whose son was a senior intelligence official with a penchant for hunting humans. That same son had called a contact at the CIA to betray his father's and Gray's plan to kill him. Why? Reese waved to a worried-looking Liz on the dock, then picked up the sat phone to call Rafe via the landline at the main ranch house.
Hannah?
Caroline Hastings picked up on the first ring, a hint of panic in her usually steady voice.
No, I'm sorry, Caroline, it's Reese.
Is Rafe there?
He couldn't wait. He's in the air on his way to Romania to look for Hannah. She hasn't answered her phone or any of our emails. Vic has the embassy trying to track her down, but Rafe doesn't trust them. He just couldn't sit around and wait.
He could tell she'd been crying. Reese paused. I would have done the same.
I know.
Is Vic still there?
Yes, but he's about to return to D.C.,
the Hastings matriarch answered after composing herself. Good. Please tell him I'll meet him at Langley. I don't want to cause another commotion by flying back to the ranch with L.E. still combing the place. How's Katie?
She's a strong woman, Reese. I think it's all sinking in, but she's fine.
Please give her a hug for me and tell her I'll meet her at her place in Alexandria tomorrow. Can you get her home for me?
We can certainly handle that.
Thank you. I'm so sorry I brought this on you, Caroline.
Where is all this leading, Reese?
Russia. Chapter 53. Iași International Airport, Romania. The flight from Dulles was well within the 8,000-mile range of the G-550, but it was still almost 5 o'clock a.m. when they finally landed. The combined flights had exceeded the crew rest requirements for the two pilots, but given the emergency nature of the trip, they were willing to push it. Despite the creature comforts of Thorne's Gulf Stream, for Rafe, rest was an impossibility. Rafe rented a car as rapidly as was possible in Romania from a man speaking passable English and headed directly for the farm where his sister lived, driving the small Opel sedan as fast as he dared. His parents had tried to contact Hannah several times during the past 24 hours without success, and the embassy personnel had predictably been unable to track her down. A sense of dread permeated Rafe's very being. His instincts were usually correct. The navigation app he was using was next to worthless in this area, so Rafe had to rely on a paper map that he kept in his lap as he drove, just like the old days. The sun was beginning to rise, illuminating the small farmhouses and villages that dotted the rolling hills, the local residents already moving into the planted fields to bring in the harvest. It was a simple, meaningful existence, and Rafe quickly realized why his baby sister had fallen in love with it. He pulled the sedan off the road and compared the small brick building and nearby barn to a photo on his iPhone. This was the place. Not wanting to disturb anything or anyone, Rafe left the car near the road and walked toward his sister's temporary home on foot. He walked around the barn and saw that a small pickup truck, presumably belonging to Hannah, was parked outside. Maybe she was home and her internet was just down? As he walked farther, he saw that the door to the small home was open. A burst of adrenaline surged through his body as his mind put the pieces together. He was unarmed, a requirement to clear Romanian customs. The old wooden door creaked as Rafe pushed it open. A chair was on its side, and blood was visible on the tile floor. Rafe pushed the horror of the moment from his mind and put his tracking skills to work. The fact that her body wasn't here meant she was probably still alive. He pulled the small pack from his back and retrieved a pair of nitrile gloves from the first aid kit inside. At first glance, it appeared the droplets of blood on the tile floor led outside, but upon close inspection, the pattern indicated it was leading inside the home. The bleeding had begun outside. Rafe went down to his hands and knees and used a small but powerful LED light to search for evidence. A kitchen knife had slid underneath the table and appeared to be covered in blood. Hannah had fought, and for a slight moment a sense of brotherly pride broke through the pain. The beam from his light found a strand of hair that appeared to belong to his sister on the floor, an arm's reach away from the knife. Rafe backtracked outside and searched the soft, dry ground. He paced the area with his eyes on the ground, stopping, kneeling, then going prone, just as Melusi had taught him back in Africa.
"The tracks will tell the story. Let them speak."
After 20 minutes of study, those tracks had given their testimony. A vehicle, a van by the looks of it, had stopped by the road, and two large males wearing work boots had stepped out. One set of boot tracks led to the back of the home, where he'd knelt, next to the door. The other set of tracks led to the front door. It swung outward, and he'd positioned himself on the hinge side so that he would be hidden when it opened. A woman wearing high-heeled boots had traded places with the driver and driven the van up the driveway toward the home. The tracks led to the door where she'd likely lured Hannah outside. The man had probably pounced on his sister from behind in the darkness, and based on the greenish hue of the blood trail, had taken a knife to the guts for his trouble. Hannah had been subdued just outside the back door. The drag marks left by her feet led to the van, which indicated that she'd been unconscious, either knocked out, drugged, or both.
Where would they take her?
That was the psychology of tracking. Learn from the spoor and anticipate your prey's next move. Rafe needed to get inside the head of whoever had taken her. The tracks were only a few hours old, but Rafe didn't have any leads as to where they might be headed. He was in an unfamiliar land, didn't speak the language, and had no local network on which to rely. Rafe walked back inside the farmhouse, and this time his eyes were up, looking for anything he'd missed on his first pass. He didn't have to look far. A piece of paper was on the small kitchen table, torn from a notebook. On it was written a URL of seemingly nonsensical letters, numbers, and symbols, followed by two additional sets of similarly random alphanumeric combinations without the URL designation.
A username and password. The dark web.
Feeling a vibration, Rafe reached in his pocket and answered the phone.
"Tell me," he said. "It's not good. Did you find Hannah? I'm at her place now. She's been taken."
Rafe heard his friend pause on the other end of the line.
"I know who did it and where she is," Rhys said.
When Rhys was finished relaying the information he'd learned from the interrogation of Dmitry Mashkov, Rafe's eyes moved back to the paper in his hand.
"He's hunting her," he said. "Or he's using her as bait. Come back and I'll talk to Vic about mounting an operation to get her out. There's no time for that. He wants me or he wants you, probably both. See what you can do about it through official channels. In the meantime, I'm going to book a hunt."
Chapter 54. Medny Island, Russia. Alexander sat at his desk in his fortress on Medny. The island was first sighted in 1741 by Vitus Jonassen Bering, a Danish cartographer employed by the Russian Navy. It wasn't until a few years later that Emelyan Basov explored and hunted the island, bringing back a host of valuable furs to Kamchatka and on to trading posts throughout Russia. Alexander looked at a seal pelt on the wall.
"Fitting," he thought.
Native Aleuts had moved to the island in the late 1800s and set up a whaling station. Relying on harpoons, they hunted whales and seals until the government moved the settlement to neighboring Bering Island. It was a frontier post with Cold War military significance up until 2001, when it was abandoned. The Zharkov family dacha on the Black Sea would not do for what Alexander had in mind, so, when the opportunity presented itself, the entrepreneurial young intelligence officer had leased the island from the government. He needed a remote outpost to partake in his most dangerous of games. Siberia was remote. An island in the Bering Sea was even more so. Hunting the woman from Montana had ended in a most unsatisfying manner. He hadn't been able to feel the pleasure of releasing his arrow into his quarry. She'd also managed to kill two of his best dogs. No matter. Sergei had others to take their place. Luckily for him, a plane was about to land at a remote strip in Kamchatka. There, six new prisoners from the Central African Republic would be transferred to an MIA transport helicopter for the flight to Medny Island. They would provide ample opportunity to sharpen his skills before the ultimate chess match.
"Americans were so easy to manipulate."
Hannah Hastings had served her purpose. Alexander had received word that an American had arrived in Romania and traveled to her farmhouse. It wouldn't be long before he put the pieces together and connected via the dark web using the note left on his sister's table. The trap was baited. Now it was time to wait. His prey would come, and Alexander would finally put himself to the test against the most worthy of adversaries. He felt like more tea.
"Sergei," he called out.
Where was that mongrel half-breed? Probably out training the dogs or practicing with that old bow of his. Sergei and all those who carried the blood of his people remained stuck in the past. Aboriginals fretting out a meager existence much as they had for centuries. They had not adapted to the changing environment. They had even attempted to defend themselves against Russian colonization with bows and spears. The result had been catastrophic. Where disease and war failed, alcoholism and forced migration picked up the slack. Sergei, whose Koryak blood had been diluted through breeding and the ravages of a war the world knew little about, still favored the ancient bow of his people over the modern crossbow that Alexander carried on their hunts. Alexander scoffed at the thought. The Siberian native had been conscripted into the Russian army. There, he'd excelled in the ranks of the Spetsnaz, serving with distinction in the Second Chechen War, putting down the insurgency using the tactics and techniques that had earned them the respect of the Mujahideen in the Soviet-Afghan campaign. Sergei's unit had been responsible for the targeted assassinations of Chechen separatist leadership by any means necessary. In the Russian army, he'd learned an appreciation for the Russian martial art of Sambo, to which he continued to devote himself with zeal. Alexander couldn't fathom why the huge Koryak dedicated so much time to unarmed combat. After all, his size seemed sufficient to deal with anyone reckless enough to fight him hand to hand. It seemed to be the one vestige of his time spent with the Spetsnaz that he carried forward into his work for Alexander. He'd spent months building a baidarka, a kayak made of driftwood, with a deck covered in seal and sea lion skins. The fool even hunted from it, in the tradition of his people. He knew the dogs, though, and, much like the canines whose company he kept, he was loyal to the man who fed him. For that, Alexander would allow him his little bow and kayak. A light on a computer used for only one purpose roused him from his musings. Alexander hovered over a Tor network icon and depressed his keypad before entering a 28-character password and entering the world of the dark web. The platforms that hosted illicit activity on the dark web changed as international consortiums of law enforcement built cases on a virtual battlefield. Silk Road, Alpha Bay, and Hansa were but a few of the cyber auction houses whose specialties catered to the dark side of man. Weapons, child pornography, human trafficking, and illicit drugs were the mainstays of the realm, traded for with Bitcoin cryptocurrency, moving people and destroying lives at 50 megabits a second. The dark web was where Alexander offered a specific service to a discerning and niche customer. It was where Alexander offered the hunt of a lifetime. To those who had adorned their walls with most every species the planet had to offer, a few longed for one more trophy, one they wouldn't be able to brag about at cocktail parties in polite society. They yearned to experience the hunting of man. Marketed via the dark web, the prey were described as prisoners destined for execution. These hunters would be fulfilling a civic duty. For $500,000 U.S. in Bitcoin, rich Russians, Europeans, and Americans had traveled to Medny for the experience that had thus far eluded them in life. Alexander ran his tongue along his bottom lip as he read the email.
"It is so nice to make your acquaintance, Mr. Rainsford."
Part 3. The Kill. I am still a beast at bay. Sanger Rainsford, The Most Dangerous Game by Richard Connell. Chapter 55. Boundary County, Idaho, United States-Canadian border. Reese would have preferred to somehow bring Dimitri's body back to the Hastings' property and leave it where a bear could dispose of it. Dimitri dying in the firefight at the ranch made a lot more sense than him sustaining life-threatening wounds there, then wandering 100 miles to a property coincidentally owned by Tim Thornton. But with law enforcement still combing the crime scenes, Reese and Liz had no choice but to dispose of the body in the deepest part of the lake.
"I think the chairs are goner, buddy,"
Liz said as they contemplated how to clean up the cabin. I'm afraid you're right. Donning surgical masks from the med bag and using bleach from under the sink, they cleaned off the leather chair as best they could. The tarp and towels went into a trash bag along with the coffee grinder, French press, and baking tray. Reese dismantled the chair with an axe and wrapped it in trash bags as well. When they were done sanitizing the crime scene, they loaded it all into the plane. With Thorne's G550 somewhere in Eastern Europe and wanting to get things moving as quickly as possible, Reese had Liz drop him in Billings. Liz borrowed a van from the corporate jet center and took her trash to a landfill. Reese was able to catch a commercial Delta flight to Minneapolis that connected into Washington Reagan National. After spending several months of solitude in a rural and isolated environment, it took Reese some time to adjust to the sights and sounds of the modern world. His mind had adapted to the natural order of the wilderness and rebelled against his re-entry into society. By 10 o'clock p.m., he was relieved to be stepping through the doorway of Katie's condo in Old Town Alexandria. "I told you it wouldn't be long," he said. Katie had beaten him to Virginia by 30 minutes, and despite the late hour, she made coffee, while Reese caught her up on the developments of the past 48 hours. "How are you feeling?" Reese asked. "Like I'm grateful that I wasn't kidnapped by a psycho assassin who likes to wrap women's heads in debt cord. Thank goodness for small favors." "I'm okay, Reese. I just keep thinking about how lucky we were that Caroline Hastings is such a great shot, and that you showed up when you did, and..."
"And what?"
"I'd be lying if I said I didn't wonder if life with you is always going to be this way."
Reese nodded. "I've wondered the same thing myself.
Before we delve into that, though, I have an important question to ask. Do you have any honey?"
"Ha! Oh, yeah. I forgot you take your coffee like most of my old sorority sisters."
Returning to the table with honey in a small carton of half and half, she watched as Reese doctored his brew.
"I have something to tell you, Katie, and I need your help to think it through."
"What is it?"
"Rafe's little sister, Hannah, is missing. She was working in Romania, and not long after we were attacked, someone took her."
"What?"
Katie whispered in disbelief.
"The same people who were after you?"
Forcing the rational side of her brain to restrain her emotions, she closed her eyes and processed the news.
"How can I help?"
"Well..."
"Hold on," Katie interrupted. She picked up her iPad and phone, depositing them in her bedroom before closing the door. She then unplugged the LCD television hanging on the wall of her living room. Satisfied, she picked up a legal pad and sat back down.
"You're as paranoid as I am."
"It's not paranoia if someone's really after you," she said.
"I've heard that somewhere before," Reese thought.
"Here's what we know. Oliver Gray was a CIA analyst who went off the grid several months ago. It turns out he was working for Vasily Andrenov, a former colonel in the GRU. He recruited Gray near the end of the Cold War and kept him on retainer even after the fall of the Soviet Union and Andrenov's ouster from the new Russian government."
"He's the Russian billionaire who was blown up in Switzerland last year?"
"That's him. Gray helped plan the operation that killed the Russian president and attempted to kill ours. After the follow-on chemical attack in Odessa, he went underground and ended up in Argentina."
"I thought they only hid Nazis."
"They're branching out. Anyway, after that, he makes his way to St. Petersburg, Russia, and started working for someone named Ivan Zharkov, who runs one of the big crime families in the Bratva, the Russian mafia."
"Why would Gray want to kill you? Why wouldn't he just lie low in Russia?"
"I can think of a couple of reasons. First is that he knows I'm going to track him down." "He's right about that. He's one of two people left who had a hand in killing Freddy. He wanted to put me down before I got the chance."
Katie frowned at the casual way Reese referred to killing, like it was a normal everyday occurrence, and she had to remind herself that for him, it was.
"And the second?"
Reese thought of the stainless steel Submariner that used to adorn his father's wrist. He'd purchased it in a PX in Vietnam and worn it every day Reese could remember. I think Gray had my father killed, Katie. I can't prove it, but I've been doing some reading while I was in the mountains. I asked Vic for some files after the Odessa incident.
When you save the life of the president, it probably opens a few file cabinets. It doesn't hurt.
I had Vic put together a list of my father's postings at the CIA from just before 9/11 until his death. Oliver Gray was in Buenos Aires the night my father was killed.
I thought you told me he was an analyst. A desk guy.
He was. I think he used the recruitment skills that Andreyev taught him to recruit a contract agent named Jules Landry to do the actual killing.
But why, Reese? Why would a former Soviet spy want to kill your father? Because of something that happened in the Cold War? I thought a lot of the warriors on opposite sides of the Iron Curtain were actually friends now.
I wondered the same thing. It goes back farther than that. It turns out that Gray signed out a file in 1993. That file was an after-action report from a MACV-SOG operation in Vietnam that resulted in the death of a Russian advisor. Can you guess the advisor's last name?
Andreyev.
That's right. And can you guess who led the mission?
Tom Reese.
Right again. I think Andreyev recruited Gray to find out who killed his father, and then all those years later finally got his revenge.
I think we need to switch to something stronger than Black Rifle coffee. I need a drink,
Katie said, standing up to retrieve two glasses from the cabinet.
I don't have any Semper yet, but I do have a nice bottle of Sea Smoke.
That'll do.
It's a 2013 10. My dad gets a case on his birthday every year from his golfing buddy, Nick Kasulis. He and his wife Tina own a golf course out in California and get it at cost for the restaurant there. My dad always saves me a bottle,
Katie said as Reese organized his thoughts. That's nice of him.
That reminds me. There's no good time to tell you. He sent me three boxes to give to you. My parents were listed as next of kin when your mom passed away. You were presumed dead, so the nursing home shipped the last of her things to my parents. I have them in the back closet, when you want them.
Thanks, Katie. I'll go through them when this is all over. Now, where were we?
You were just getting to the part where Gray almost kills us?
Right. I think Gray saw an opportunity to use both the protection and resources of the Russian mob to launch a hit on me on U.S. soil.
Why Rafe as well?
That's the question I'm going to put to Vic tomorrow.
And who tipped off the CIA about the attack in Montana?
That's where this gets a little strange. A former agency case officer who spent a lot of time in Russia got a call from a Russian intelligence official named Alexander Zharkov, warning him of the attack. He called Vic, who contacted us just in time.
Any relation to Ivan Zharkov?
It's his son.
So let me get this straight.
Katie's analytical mind was going to work.
A Russian mob boss hires a former CIA mole who then plans your murder but gets sold out by the Mafia Don's son?
As best as I can figure it.
Anywhere else but Russia, that would be crazy.
Fair point, Reese conceded.
Maybe they went after Hannah when the attack in Montana failed to draw you and Rafe out so they can try again?
It's possible.
There's something you're not telling me, isn't there?
Reese nodded. During my interrogation of the Russian who survived the attack, he told me that Alexander Zharkov imports humans to his own private hunting ground on an island off the Kamchatka Peninsula.
To do what?
Katie asked, already dreading the answer. He hunts them. Rafe is on his way there now. I'm going to see if I can talk Vic into mounting a rescue operation, but the odds of that happening are slim. What I really need from him is information.
Why, may I ask?
This is the part you might not want to hear. Katie took off her small pair of black-rimmed glasses and set them on the legal pad covered with her hastily scribbled notes and looked at him, her blue eyes clouded with sadness.
Even if the CIA says no, you're leaving again, aren't you?
It's my fault, Katie. The attack in Montana, Hannah's disappearance, now Rafe. I need to find her. One way or another, after I get what I can from the agency, I'll have to go.
Where?
Medney Island.
Chapter 56. Central Intelligence Agency, Langley, Virginia. It was early and they'd beaten rush hour, so traffic on the George Washington Parkway was relatively light. It was already hot and oppressively humid, the aging Forerunner's air conditioning struggling to cool the SUV's interior. As they made the scenic drive along the Potomac River, Reese couldn't help but think about the last time they'd been on this road together, going to say goodbye to his parents at Arlington. It looked different now, the deep snow having transformed into lush green grass. They drove by the airport on the right and then the Pentagon on the left, and eventually past Arlington National Cemetery. Sweat-soaked joggers and cyclists were out in force on the sidewalks that flanked the river, many of them crossing the Memorial Bridge into D.C. proper. Katie took the exit that led directly to the north security gate and rolled down her window as they approached a team of guards wearing body armor and BDU-style uniforms. Reese leaned over the console and held out his green contractor badge for the officer to inspect. "She's just dropping me off. I've got a meeting at 6:30.
"No problem, sir, but you're going to have to get out here. We can give you a ride up to the building."
"Thanks." He turned to Katie. "I'll text you when I'm done."
"You be safe, James Reese."
"Semper," he said with a wink. The security officer directed Katie to where she could make a U-turn, and another waved Reese toward a Chevy Equinox with a light bar on the roof for the short drive to the headquarters building. Reese had been to CIA headquarters on a few occasions in the past, but had never asked about a large black aircraft that towered above the road on a pedestal. "Is that an SR-71?
"Everyone thinks that, but it's actually an A-12 ox cart, the agency's version. It was a tad faster than the Blackbird, and it only had one crew member."
"Guess you've answered that question before."
"Every day, man, every damn day. Here we are,"
the officer said as he pulled the small SUV to the curb outside the new and old headquarters buildings.
"Thanks for the ride."
He had scrounged up a collared shirt, but even if he'd worn a suit, there was nothing about James Reese that blended in at Langley. He entered the hallowed ground of the old building, stepping across the mosaic Central Intelligence Agency seal. As was his custom, he walked to the Wall of Honor on the north side of the lobby, where black stars, representing the fallen, were chiseled into the white marble. Flanked by the flag of the nation and the flag of the agency, the stars were a daily reminder to those who crossed the threshold that they were the country's first line of defense. Above the 133 stars were the words, "In honor of those members of the Central Intelligence Agency who gave their lives in the service of the country." Reese looked down at the glass case protruding from the wall that held the Book of Honor under lock and key. A black Moroccan goatskin logbook lay in wait for its inch-thick glass to be opened yet again, for another date to be inscribed and sometimes a name to correspond with a new star on the wall above. Reese slowly scanned the names visible through the glass in silent respect, hovering over those he knew. He was in the company of warriors. The page had already been turned on the 79th star representing Johnny Mike Spann from one of the first battles in the War on Terror. It had also been turned on the page with Chris Mueller and Chief, whose actions under fire in Afghanistan defined heroism. The current pages displayed under protective glass were almost at capacity, and soon the page would be turned yet again. Reese's eyes hovered over the names of Redacted, Glenn Doherty, Ty Woods, and Redacted. 19 other stars stood out on the page, names withheld. Reese knew more than a few, their names and the circumstances of their deaths locked away on secure hard drives and in the memories of those who were there. Reese ran his fingers over the newest star, the one that represented his friend, Freddie Strain.
Reese had been there for the ceremony, as had the president. Memories of his old teammate flashed through his mind. Sniper school, their first post-9/11 deployment, Mozambique, Odessa, the funeral, Freddy's family. Reese closed his eyes, Freddy's face coming to him from beyond the grave. "I'm sorry, brother," Reese whispered, knowing that if it were not for him, Freddy's kids would still have a father. He closed his eyes tighter. "I'd trade places with you if I could. I should be the one in the ground." Freddy smiled, his face blurring in Reese's memory, morphing into another face. This one was hazy, and Reese couldn't quite make it out, but the blur had a name, Nizar Khatan, the Syrian sniper who had pressed the trigger that took Freddy as he rendered aid to a wounded Secret Service agent on a rooftop half a world away. Reese had anonymously set up a trust to take care of Freddy's special needs child. The money he'd used had been a reward from the British Crown for taking out the terrorist some had come to call Europe's Osama bin Laden. Reese knew that Freddy's was one of the names not written next to his star. Classified. Just like the star that represented Thomas Reese. A bureaucrat somewhere in the building had decided omitting the names was necessary so as not to expose certain sources and methods. Reese stepped back and took a breath, composing himself as CIA staff came and went behind him, wearing suits and carrying briefcases. Glancing at the opposite wall, Reese read the unofficial motto of the Central Intelligence Agency from Scripture, John chapter 8, verse 32. "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." "We'll see," he thought. Reese badged through the turnstile and headed for the elevators. He felt the eyes of staffers, agents, executives, and security officers burning through him. As he navigated the maze of the world's premier intelligence service, he remembered that it wasn't that long ago they'd been part of the manhunt to capture and kill him. Vic's administrative assistant waved him through the open door into a spacious office. They didn't bother sitting. Instead, they walked directly into the adjoining SCIF, Secure Compartmented Information Facility, which was a fancy name for a secure conference room. Reese placed his iPhone into what looked like a small post office box, locking it inside and pocketing the key. Once inside the soundproof room, he took a seat across from the Director of Clandestine Services.
"It's good to see you, Reese. Thanks for coming in."
"Good to see you too, sir."
"If you came on board full-time, we could do this on a regular basis. You might even get a parking spot one day."
"We'll see how it goes. What do you have for me?"
Reese had briefed Vic on the phone from Billings, speaking in riddles in case unwanted ears were listening. Vic tapped a key on a secure laptop that was connected to a large LCD screen on the wall.
"The Bureau folks have been surprisingly generous with sharing information on this one. Frankly, I think an attack on U.S. soil against a former senator, whether he was the target or not, scared the shit out of them."
Reese nodded.
"As you know, there were two teams, the one that attempted to ambush you on the highway and the second that moved on your friend Rafe at the ranch."
A group of pictures, along with an aerial photo of the ambush site, appeared on the screen.
"After you drive out of the ambush, the first team moves to the ranch where Caroline Hastings puts a world of hurt on them until you arrive. We believe that everyone on that team has been accounted for."
Vic advanced the slides, and a close-up of six dead bodies were displayed.
"Except for the female they used as bait," Reese said.
"Correct,"
Vic continued, tapping the arrow key again. A photo of an attractive young woman filled the screen.
"We've determined that she was working in Whitefish as a bartender. She's a Russian national on a valid green card. Our guess is that she reconned this entire operation. She has not been back to work since this went down, but we'll find her."
"She looks familiar. I've seen her around town."
"On that second group, the initial forensics report says that one of them is missing. There was blood on the scene with no body to match. You know anything about that?"
Reese shook his head.
Didn't think you would. They're still running full profiles, but it looks like they were all ethnic Russians.
The tattoos made that clear. Anything on the weapons?
ATF is working on it, but they were all Russian-made AKMs, so they didn't come through legal channels. Millions of those guns were made, so that probably won't give us much to go on.
What about Hannah Hastings? Anything on who might have grabbed her? Reese asked, wanting to confirm his findings from the interrogation.
Nothing yet. We pulled in some local assets to investigate, and our station chief in Bucharest is working with their national police force, but honestly, I'm not optimistic.
Do you have any theories?
Smart Money says they grabbed her as a consolation prize when the attack on you and Ray failed, but there's something else. Something darker.
What? Reese asked.
After the accusations and evidence of Russian intelligence meddling in our elections, infiltrating social media platforms to influence our political process, the director is not in the mood to play games with them. The power vacuum left by the assassination of their president has their intelligence agencies running wild without adult supervision. Financial crimes, the election meddling. It's like we're back in the Cold War, but without the rules. We've done a deep dive on their leadership, particularly Alexander Zharkov. Our cyber capabilities are impressive thanks to some help from Silicon Valley. We all know that there is human trafficking that's being facilitated through the dark web, and we've found evidence tying Zharkov to brokering humans as prey for trophy hunting. For $500,000, you get to hunt what they call criminals destined for the gallows.
The most dangerous game.
Exactly. Our records show that Zharkov is a big hunter type, shot animals all over the world while posted overseas for the SVR. At some point, his tastes crossed over from four-legged to two-legged game. You know what Hemingway said, once you've hunted man.
That all squares with what I found out on my end.
Oh, really? Vic asked with renewed interest.
Do you think that Alexander blows his father's op so that he can have a crack at me and Rafe?
That's my own pet theory, yes?
And he's using Hannah for the bait.
Vic nodded.
That confirms what I learned in a conversation with a recently deceased Russian mobster.
I am going to pretend I believe it was just a conversation, Vic said.
Now your intel is confirmed via my humint. What are our next steps?
The director is preparing a presidential finding that would authorize a hostage rescue mission. She thinks the connection to you and Freddy and the attempted assassination will help sway the president. He's not running for re-election, and if we can convince him that this won't start World War III, I think we have a chance. You did save his life, after all.
Even so, he's not going to greenlight a hostage rescue on Russian soil.
Don't be so sure. The operators will all use AKs to make it look like it's a Russian criminal syndicate hit on the son of Bratva leadership. Just enough plausible deniability and confusion to make this a non-attributable action. Believe me, if you knew half the classified history of this place, you'd know this is one of the most sane paramilitary operations the CIA has ever proposed. If denied, we'll have no choice but to pass it to Alpha Group via diplomatic channels.
Alpha Group? Vic, we do that and she's dead.
I know.
Who's got it from our side? Redacted? Redacted.
Commander has two COAs,
Vic continued, using the acronym for Courses of Action.
The first is SEALs from Redacted, jumping into the Pacific just south of the Bering Sea to link up with an amphib. From there, they head south to rendezvous with a submarine carrying a platoon from SDV-1 on a
Redacted.
They'll come from the sea, hit the lodge, and extract back out to sea, just like we've done with
Redacted, Redacted, Redacted
in the past. It's a proven COA.
Even with the AK ploy, if someone goes down and gets left behind, facial recognition technology will confirm it was us.
That will be fully explained to the president.
What's COA 2?
The
redacted
commander is an army general, so he wants
redacted
in on the action as well, Vic said, using one of the nicknames for the army's redacted,
better known to the public as
Redacted. Second COA is to launch Redacted in MHX Blackhawks from an amphib in and out.
Riskier COA, Reese observed, remembering the Army helicopter that went down on his last Afghanistan deployment.
True. We are pushing for COA-1, but it will take a couple days longer to get that one in motion. We are lucky that SDV was deployed for a redacted. Part of their workup is the redacted. National Command Authority will advise the President.
Vic, you know if the President tries to go through diplomatic channels, he's signing Hannah's death warrant.
I promise I'll do everything I can to ensure that doesn't happen.
Reese leaned back in his chair, his mind racing to analyze the possible contingencies. I need to be there.
Negative.